ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I want you to think about where you live. The places that shape your everyday life. The corner shop where you buy milk. The cafe you pass each morning. The street you always walk up to catch the bus. How much of that material world is part of who you are? And how would you feel if it were all suddenly gone, erased by the chaos of war?
The emotional loss and the trauma connected with losing the landmarks. You know, when you walk around your beloved city, you have these landmarks. They're part of your sort of internal navigational axis. And when they're gone, you feel that every day when you walk the streets.
This is a destruction that aims at uprooting people from their land and their history. And it's done in a very scientific and methodological way. Where you go to these villages, the level of destruction is so high that you can't find the road.
Today, on By Design, we're exploring what it means to protect buildings during times of conflict. Not just the famous monuments or World Heritage sites, but the ordinary streets, homes and neighbourhoods that hold local memory and lived history. What does it mean to destroy a building during times of war?
Beirut has been split. It's a split city by now, where some areas are being extremely targeted by the bombing, and the bombing is expanding. So before it was limited to the southern suburb, but on every day there are what is called targeted bombing or targeted killing, which you never know what part of the city that will take.
That's Joanne Bajali, former journalist, now heritage activist, living and working in Beirut, a city under attack. And her work, it's extraordinary. As bombs are falling on her city, Joanne is trying to protect important buildings and homes. I mean, forget your NIMBYs and your YIMBYs. This is a battle for the built environment unlike anything you've ever seen. No stranger to war, Joanne was reporting during the 2003 Iraq War when she witnessed the looting of the Baghdad Museum. That moment changed everything, leading her to found Biladi, an NGO dedicated to protecting heritage sites like museums and cultural artifacts. In recent years, her focus has expanded to include the streetscapes of southern Lebanon.
So after the 2024 war, we started working on documenting the destruction that was taking place in South Lebanon on the villages that were either located on the border or far away from the border. We are talking about villages located within Lebanon. So this is Lebanese territory. These are Lebanese villages. And when we went there, it was the deliberate act of destruction, not regular destruction. This is not my first war. I have been from Iraq to Lebanon to many wars. This is a destruction that aims at uprooting people from their land and their history. And it's done in a very, very scientific and methodological way. Where you go to these villages, the level of destruction is so high that you can't find the road. So you don't know where the road is. You just walk on any road that is there. And the landmarks that were there have all disappeared. Even the graveyards, you know, tanks were driven on graveyards. So people didn't just lose their houses. They lost their landmarks. They lost everything that is related to their villages. You can walk from one destruction to the other, not knowing where is the historical element, because the modern element have been thrown the rubbles of the modern element over the historical element. And both have been moved away so that even the roads are no longer clear. So this is a technique that is being used so that people cannot find any link to their history, to their previous history or their previous memory as a person. Forget the passing on of the memory from one space, from one person to the other and one generation to the other. Plus, you add to all this that there was a deliberate action of destruction of the natural heritage by using phosphorus, for instance, or different kind of pesticide that are killing the crops and the trees.
So there's a complete kind of reset through this absolute destruction that's going on there, yeah?
Yes, Anthony, it's something that we have witnessed that is extremely new, which is void. So you feel that there is no more energy there. There's no more life there. Beyond emptiness, it's void.
These kinds of villages, I mean, they've evolved over generations, haven't they? They've been, people's houses have been in the family through a number of generations. So these aren't sort of new suburbs.
No, no, no. There's absolutely no new suburbs there. We're talking about villages that are old. Between some of them will have monuments that are 500 years old. Others will have monuments that sometimes they go back to 700 years old. The ancestral family villages go back to at least 200 years old. So we're talking about historical villages that have organically grown with time, with the family expansion and the children adding houses to the ancestral family house. We're not talking about anything modern here. We're talking about traditional houses and traditional villages that have been passed on from one generation to the other for the last 500, 600, 700 years. And we're talking about also the historical monuments, such as the mosques, such as the churches, or even the shrines. Everything have been destroyed in southern Lebanon, up next to the border. And the area that is a little bit located a little bit more further to the border, that's where the destruction is taking place, and it's an uprooting of the population. But because people were able to go back in 2024, they were able to rebuild some of it. When, you know, they have worked this out, where in one areas they have made it impossible to return, and in other areas people were able to return.
So amongst all of this like systematic destruction that's going on, what is the work you're trying to do here? What's the value that you're trying to bring to this diabolical situation?
We work on two different levels. Either we work on antiquities and archaeological sites and storages, which is done with private collections or with the government institutions, where we try to secure the collections outside of the bombing areas. Or we work on the villages and the communities where we try to document what they had and what they have lost. Because once you know, you cannot unknow. And we want them to know what they have lost as it being part of the history. So adding the scientific element of architectural history or the value of the historical houses, that adds another layer of pain that is true, where you even know even more that the house that you have lost is not just your family house, it's also a historical building. But at the same time, it adds also an element of pride that now we know what we have lost in terms of not just me and my memories, but as a general loss for the nation. So we document what have been lost in order to assess the level of damage assessment or destruction assessment. And we provide these information back to the communities. And we give this to the policy level at the government level for any reconstruction plan that will be worked upon for the South in order for it to include the historical buildings as part of the reconstruction plan and remunerate people accordingly in order to push for the preservation of the history.
So there's a kind of an archaeology of resistance going on here, and the uses of this archive that you're, or the work that you're doing, the surveying work and the archaeology that you're doing, is about maintaining that memory, maintaining its access to that memory. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. We see it also as an act of resistance to a war that aims at also eradicating the history of the place. Of course, it's a pacific resistance, but it's still resistance, and it's a cultural resistance to any act of cutting the link between people and their history or a population and their history, and keeping the knowledge and the remembrance alive.
Our streetscapes are a core part of our identity, especially when those streets and homes carry generations of family and cultural history. But they're not the only parts of the built environment that matter. From places of worship to fountains and statues, these spaces shape who we are and how we belong. In 1954, the Hague Convention became the first international treaty to protect cultural heritage during war, requiring armies to safeguard significant sites and avoid targeting them in conflict. But getting combatants to follow the convention isn't always straightforward. Professor Peter Stone understands that challenge. As president of Blue Shield International, which works to protect cultural heritage during armed conflict, he realized that if heritage was going to be protected, the military first had to see it through their own lens.
I actually had to learn a new language, and the language I had to learn was military speak. So I stopped talking about World Heritage Sites and national institutions and started talking about potential force multipliers. What that means to you and me is that it is something that they can do with very little extra staffing or thought, but it is something that can make their job significantly more easy. And this is where you get into the real issues about why protecting cultural property can be so important. So in 2003-04, the Iraqi population were beginning to say, why are coalition troops still here? By 2006, they were saying, we really want the coalition troops to go home. And there was still no protection of heritage or religious sites. So it was dead easy for a group of Sunni extremists to walk into the Al-Aqshiri Mosque in Samarra, the third holiest place in Shia Islam, and blow it up. And that is seen by many of the political commentators on that conflict and the situation as one of the key tipping points into the full-scale sectarian civil war. And that led to a civil war of 5 years just over. And in political coalition minds, that led to the coalition troops having to stay in Iraq for that further 5 years. If it's not bad enough taking 5 years worth of casualties and fatalities, spending 5 years losing the propaganda war. And that war was won by the so-called insurgents and provided the environment for the re-emergence of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and allowed for the oxygen for the emergence of the so-called Islamic State. Now, neither of those are going to disappear in my lifetime. And I'm not saying there was a simple, direct, and one only link between the destruction of the mosque and the emergence and re-emergence of those two organizations, but there was a very firm, heavily dotted line between the two.
That's a strong argument for protecting places of cultural significance during war. But I can't imagine that when the bombs are falling, it's an easy point to get across. This is why Peter Stone says that the work of protection should be happening before the conflict erupts.
We have to work in peacetime with all of those different groups. So we work, as an example at the moment, closely with NATO on their exercises and training work. And what we try to do is embed ideas about cultural property protection into that training and those exercises so that they begin to slowly realize that actually the protection of heritage could be as important as the logistics for keeping the ammunition going to the frontline troop. They are beginning to understand.
That was my next question. Are they starting to listen?
They are starting to listen. So there is a thing that most people generically call a no-strike list that the military pull together if they're going into a conflict. And that is always headed by medical facilities, educational facilities, and quite often sort of community facilities. But they now add to that heritage sites. And we work fairly closely with them to provide information for those heritage sites. So as one example of that, troops loyal to President Gaddafi in Libya. And NATO targeteer sitting on an airfield in the Netherlands identified 6 vehicles of a mobile radar and communications unit loyal to Gaddafi parked up inside and immediately outside a large derelict building. And they identified a weapon to take all of those out in one go. So one large weapon that would hit this derelict building, destroy all 6 of the vehicles, and that would be delivered from literally miles away so that no NATO Air Force troops or whoever would be under any particular danger. I don't know the detail of what happened next, but it was the equivalent of a red light flashed on his or her computer, because the coordinates for their derelict building were the same coordinates for a Roman monument that we had asked not to be damaged, if at all possible. And so the decision went further up the military food chain, and a decision was taken to, in military speak, modify the ordnance. So instead of using one big bomb to destroy everything, they used 6 precision weapons which targeted each of the individual vehicles. And we have photographic evidence from a team that went in soon afterwards from Blue Shield. And there are all six of those essentially tangled mebs of metal. And there's a tiny bit of shrapnel damage on one wall of the Roman monument.
Okay. So the precision from the big, you know, the big attack became a very precise attack to save the monument, effectively, because of the advice coming from the Blue Shield.
NATO got something that they were very unused to at the time, which was a lot of good international publicity. And they got so much of that publicity that they actually decided to set up a report as to what they had done.
So with something like the Hague Convention, has anyone actually been prosecuted under that convention and found guilty for destroying major heritage sites? Have there been any successful prosecutions?
Yeah, unfortunately, under Hague, no. But Hague is seen as the primary piece of international legislation that links to other elements. So the key one is the 1998 Rome Statute, the statute that created the International Criminal Court. And lawyers, as you'll no doubt be aware, are very conservative individuals, and they like to prosecute under something that there is a history of prosecution. So because nobody has prosecuted anybody under Hague, they don't want to be the first to try, because that may be more difficult. There are examples under the Rome Statute and under the International Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia where people have been prosecuted and convicted for crimes against cultural property.
Wow.
And the most sort of famous of those are the gentleman who first fired on the World Heritage site of the city of Dubrovnik back in the 1990s, and Mr. Almadi, who was in charge of an Ansandine team in Timbuktu in Mali, where he and his team destroyed a mosque and nine mausolea because they were, in his words, idolatrous, because they had a building above ground. And so it can be done. It has been done. It's, you know, a good process that we should be pushing it as well.
When it comes to protecting an existing structure, a strike list can save it from destruction. But what happens when that fails? For heritage activists, the pen really can be mightier than the sword, with documentation becoming one of their most powerful tools. Dr. Anya Kotaba is the president of Blue Shield Australia, an associate professor at the University of Adelaide, and an archaeologist trained across the Middle East, even teaching first aid for cultural heritage in conflict zones. I had to start by asking what that actually entails.
The concept really stems from, you know, first aid in medicine, right? So it's providing this very first response, which may not necessarily be perfect, but it's there to stabilize, it's there to document, and it's there to preserve as much as possible. So there are numerous sort of frameworks in which we work and an algorithm for protection of these sites that are in some form of distress, as the patient would be. So in many cases, the only thing that we can do in a first instance is to check for safety, is to document as much as possible with, you know, with the advancement of 3D modeling and documentation techniques. It is actually possible to now turn a photograph, a simple one photograph taken on your mobile phone, and build a 3D model of the site out of that. So the documentation is absolutely the key part of the first aid, and everything is obviously recorded. Often there's obviously stabilization of the site and all of the architectural elements and materials that have been, for example, shattered or destroyed, so that they can be then catalogued and labelled and sort of set aside and put in a safe place, if that is possible, obviously, for future reconstruction.
So now you work in documenting and modelling heritage spaces. Maybe just for our listeners, how can you describe the ways in which the technology that you're using has changed over the last, let's say, decade or so?
Oh, the advancements were absolutely huge. I remember when I was a student and I worked in Syria, I was there during the last year's campaign before the war erupted, and I'm Polish, and there was a very big Polish expedition that was working Palmyra since 1960s. So a lot of recording documentation, you know, architectural drawings of the ruins in Palmyra were kept at the University of Warsaw where I was studying. So when Palmyra had been blasted out by ISIS, and a lot of the archive, the Syrian owned archive, has also been lost, it was up to those who had the remaining, you know, part of the archive in Warsaw to start to reconstruct the Palmyra, the site of Palmyra. And, you know, that was only a decade ago. And I remember how painstakingly we were putting this together and, you know, how long it took and what, you know, what level of the process we were involved in. And now the advancement, in especially with the AI-assisted technologies, means that you can document a site in within minutes very quickly using a mobile phone, and you can do it even remotely using drone footage. And the detail of preservation, this record, is just outstanding. So, so advancement in the techniques have been huge in the last decade.
When you think about 3D construction, digitally speaking, how accurate do you think we can be with our 3D constructions after something's been destroyed?
Yes, in terms of architectural reconstruction, we can be very, very accurate. The techniques now, we can reconstruct things within millimeters. It's all within current capacity of you know, engineers and architects and conservators. Obviously, there is a question of cost and resourcing. The more detail you want to bring in, the more expensive it will be, more painstaking the part of that process will be.
So what's the future of this kind of work then? I mean, you've mentioned that there's been a whole lot of technical innovation on the recent past. Like, where is it going?
Well, I think when people hear heritage protection, they often imagine long-term restoration. By conflict, the first stage really is much more like, you know, emergency medicine, as I just said. So you assess the scene, you decide what is most at risk, you document and as quickly as you can, you stabilize what you can, you salvage vulnerable materials, and you coordinate with engineers, with emergency responders, with humanitarian actors in this conflict, with local custodians. And then you try to build the repository that could later be used for whatever purpose community chooses. So it could be reconstructions, it could be rebuilding, it could be creating a three-dimensional hologram or digital twin. And again, it will all be dependent upon the resourcing. But at this stage, it's more a work of a paramedic.
It's more triage than long-term care.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's not a GP work, it's a paramedic's work.
So do you see then that as a potential for this kind of work? You go from that immediate triage into something which is longer-term preservation sorts of strategies?
Oh, absolutely. But I don't think that necessarily would ever be work of the Blue Shield or maybe even UNESCO. This is something that comes later, and that long-term strategy has to be planned by the local government and by the state government, you know, or whatever the lower level of federal government is in a given country, and it has to be run by their Ministry of Culture. It's a long-term strategy that needs to, but you know, it happened. It happened in Korea, it happened in Vietnam, it happened in Iraq. It slowly happened in Iraq. It will happen in Gaza. It will happen in Ukraine. It will happen in Iran. It will just take time. It will take generations. And I think that's the sort of most important thing about loss of heritage. That it's not, it's immediate. It takes one blast. It takes one shockwave. It takes one ricochet to destroy the site that has been standing for hundreds or thousands of years. And it takes then decades to rebuild it, if ever. And that sort of fabric, the community fabric around the site remains broken. And I think that is the most important thing.
Back in Lebanon, Joanne Bajali is regularly reminded by her community just how important her work is.
I recall this conversation with the mayor of a village. When we got there, the people were still on the street, and I said, I do apologize that, you know, we're looking about history when you lack water. And his answer was, but that's very good. That's a relief to know that someone is looking at history and our historical buildings, because we do not have the time to do that. And we do not have the resources to do that. We have to look for water. So go look for the history and try to save it.
I'm just wondering what in your ideal world happens next with the work that you've done and the results that you hope will emerge from this work.
In the ideal world, there wouldn't be a war where the uprooting of the population is taking place. People need their history. People need to go back to their villages. This is their land. It belongs to them. And they need to work their history in a way that they can preserve it and know the value of their heritage and the attachment to their land. So I hope our work will reduce their pain a little bit, then that's already something. Our aim is not to just safeguard heritage, is also to reduce the suffering of the population a little bit.
Joanne Bajali, founder of Biladi. When I first heard about Blue Shield and the groups that work to save cultural heritage in war zones, I imagined intrepid architects throwing themselves in front of buildings in war-torn parts of the world. What I've learned is that their work is much more complex, nuanced, and technical than I could have ever imagined. It's about using new technologies to document homes that stood for centuries and are now gone. It's collaborating with local communities, the military, and politicians, weaving together a paper trail that will ensure places of cultural significance will not disappear completely. And above all, it's a belief that our attachment to our cultural built environment is intrinsic to our sense of who we are and the ability to rebuild a sense of community once the war is over. I love getting your thoughts on the program. Are you enjoying it? What design story would you like us to cover? I'm all ears to your ideas, so keep them coming. You can email me at bydesign@abc.net.au. Thanks for spending time with us on By Design. If you liked the episode, hit follow so you don't miss what's coming next. And keep an ear out for our bonus series, Extraordinary Every Day, dropping every Thursday. Next time on By Design, how do you design a building for the neurodiverse?
Imagine yourself sitting in a cafe, and in that cafe, there are stripped walls. You've got a concrete floor, you've got tables and you've got chairs, you've got people chatting away, you've got mugs and china clinking away, people talking. On top of that, you've got an open kitchen. So you've got all of the noises and smells of the kitchen bursting out, coffee grinders. On top of that, you've got speakers which pump music into that space as well. If you can feel all of that when you're in there, even if you're not autistic, I think it's really overwhelming for many of us. But for neurodivergent people, it becomes almost inaccessible and almost hard for people just to simply go and have a quiet cup of coffee.
Join me for that next time on By Design, because in a rapidly changing world, design matters. The producer of By Design is Siobhan Hunt. The sound engineer is Ross Richardson, and the executive producer is Rhiannon Brown. This program was produced on Gadigal land and the lands of the Wurundjeri.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.